I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to support and promote public understanding for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Condor and Dr. Alana Condor at Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh. They specialize in assessing and treating brain disorders. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, it's hard to believe it's already been 12 years. But in 2003, the Human Genome Project was declared complete, and a huge scientific milestone was achieved. But since then, it's become evident that this was just the first step, albeit a giant one, in the quest to completely understand human genetics. The sequence was in hand, but there was still a mountain to climb in terms of being able to define functionality in the human genome and apply that knowledge to improving human health. Since then, considerable progress has been made, and thanks to rapidly advancing technologies and methods, we are on the brink of major advances in genetics and genomics that will fulfill the promise of the Human Genome Project and truly start to profoundly affect our understanding, treatment, and prevention of human disease. It's going to be an amazing ride, and it's coming soon. Needless to say, some of that work that will be changing the world very soon is taking place right here in the Triangle. In this case, we're talking about the Duke Center for Genomic and Computational Biology, or GCB. The GCB was one of the programs spun out in 2014 when the Duke Institute for Genomic Sciences and Policy, the IGSP, was split into three separate entities. It's an interdisciplinary center where faculty from across Duke's campus collaborate to study complex problems in genomic and computational biology, to train researchers, and to develop genomic technologies. The GCB and my guest on Radio In Vivo today, Dr. Tim Reddy, recently scored quite a coup by being named one of the five centers funded by the National Human Genome Research Institute, one of the National Institutes of Health, to share in $28 million in grants emanating from the recently launched Genomics of Gene Regulation program. We will learn all about that program and Tim's piece of it today. First, let me share a little bit more about Tim. He is an assistant professor in the GCB and the Department of Biostatistics and Bioinformatics. He holds a secondary appointment in the Department of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology. The Reddy Lab is focused on understanding how genetic variation that alters gene regulation contributes to human traits, including risk for common diseases such as diabetes. Tim received his BS in computer science from Stanford University in 2003, his PhD in bioinformatics from Boston University in 2007, and he did his postdoc back at Stanford and the Hudson Alpha Institute through 2011 under Richard Myers. Tim Reddy, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Sorry about that lengthy introduction, but I did want to get some of the baseline information out there to kind of provide the context for the material you're going to be sharing about your own work. Well, Tim, to start the discussion, why don't you give us a broad overview of your lab's work investigating the role of gene regulation in complex human traits? What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so, as you pointed out, we sort of sequenced the human genome some time ago. And, sort of subsequent to that, we had kind of marked out where many of the genes were. So these are many of the building blocks that kind of make up our bodies and the things that our bodies do. But what quickly became apparent is that, you know, if you look across populations of individuals, for example, and you look at where there's sort of differences in the genome between those individuals, a lot of those differences are happening not in the genes themselves, but in the areas around the genes where we think the effect is that you can change, how the gene is used or where the gene is used or when the gene is used. And so that sort of spawned a lot of really exciting research into understanding what these regions of the genome outside of the genes are actually doing. And sort of at the same time, over the past maybe a couple decades now, we've gotten better and better and better at finding the mutations in the genome that are contributing to disease. And what we're finding more and more is that those mutations are also occurring predominantly in the regions that are not the genes, but the regions around the genes. And so, you know, this is sort of where we're trying to kind of advance the field and understand, you know, how do we figure out which of those mutations are actually changing how genes are used? And then how do we understand if the effects on how the genes are used actually contribute to phenotype or not?
So we already knew going in that it was very complex.
Yep.
And we've learned as time has gone on, it's infinitely more complex than we used to think back in the days before the genome was sequenced.
Yeah, it's getting worse every day.
Yeah, which makes work for folks like you.
It certainly does.
Well, Tim, your work is inherently interdisciplinary. Would you describe some of the methods you employ and some of the interdisciplinary aspects of your work?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the challenges we face when dealing with the human genome is simply its size. So the human genome is 3.3 billion letters long, and then you have two copies per individual. So, you know, it's just a huge amount of sequence that you need to deal with, a huge amount of DNA that you need to deal with. You can go through, you know, base by base, nucleotide by nucleotide, letter by letter, and try to understand what they each do. That work is certainly very fruitful and you know, has generated a lot of really interesting knowledge. But we sort of come at it from a different view and say, can we actually study the whole genome at once? Can we understand all of the places that are regulating genes at once? Can we understand how variation across thousands of individuals might impact those, you know, regulatory regions, et cetera? And so, you know, when you're at that scale of working, you know, what you need is you can't look at a Excel spreadsheet anymore. You can't, you know, look at pictures on a from a gel or something like that. And what you really need are computational methods that help you kind of scan through that data, and you need statistical methods that allow you to, you know, not say by eye, I think this is different, but actually know, you know, there's a really good chance that this difference is because of my, you know, experiment or phenotype and not just due to random noise, which certainly happens. And so, you know, from that point of view, we do a lot of work in the lab developing techniques that allow us to study the function of the genome, you know, in total, sort of everything at once. And then we also work very hard to develop the analytical tools and the computational tools that allow us to take the data that come out of those experiments and make some useful conclusions from them.
So you're not only doing computational biology, as you described, but also high-throughput genetics and traditional biology and genetics work.
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things is that when you kind of can go on both sides of that coin, you know, one of the things that happens is you'll make a discovery and you need to start to follow that discovery up. And we certainly then have some of the expertise, you know, not just in my lab, but also through collaborations at Duke that allow us to take these findings and really get to into some very traditional biochemistry, biology to sort of pinpoint what the exact mechanisms are.
I see. And what is the role in your work of epigenetics?
So, you know, we... That's a great question. So there's a lot of sort of work to try to understand how the DNA sequence might control how genes are regulated. And then there's also a lot of work to show how the epigenome, so these are basically you take the DNA sequence and you can layer on the next level of complexity, which is how the DNA is modified and how the genome is packaged and in a cell and changes in the epigenome, how these modifications and packaging enzymes work or packaging proteins work, also control how the genes are regulated. And so, you know, it's always sort of a challenge as we want to understand how the DNA sequence alters how the genes are regulated. But sometimes if that sequence is further modified, we need to look at the epigenome and seeing how that's contributing as well. It certainly adds a lot of complexity to what we're looking at, and especially when it comes down to trying to figure out mechanisms. So you can have, you know, the DNA sequence might cause the effect on gene regulation. It might cause the epigenome to change, which might cause the effect on gene regulation. So there's a lot of sort of interplay there that we try to handle and deal with.
It just sounds so daunting. But it seems like the key to it really is these computational tools and analysis tools that you've been able to develop or employ.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes both ways. I mean, I think there's been a huge amount, you know, and we can sort of touch on this now or later, but mm-hmm. there's been a huge amount of development in the past, I would say, you know, 5 to 6 years now, 7 years now, in how we can actually experimentally measure various aspects of the genome. So this is going beyond just sequencing the genome, but measuring the different sort of biochemical things that the genome does. And so it's actually, you know, interesting that our ability to generate data has really just gone through the roof recently. And so I would say actually a lot of the work that we do now, you know, originally we did a lot of work developing computational approaches, but we've really been doing quite a bit of work recently to develop the next set of experiments that allow us to generate the data that we need to answer the questions. A lot of times we don't need sophisticated analysis tools from the get-go. We can get by with some simple analysis tools if we have really great data and we can generate some of that data. So, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of goes both ways. I think you'll see, you know, as we get further into things, we're going to need very sophisticated sort of statistical approaches as well. But, you know, right now I think our focus is the pendulum has been swinging at least in the other direction for a little bit.
Sure. Well, I know that in the 5 to 10 year period back when there was an identifiable gap between the ability to generate data and the bioinformatics tools to do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like that gap has very much closed.
Yeah, it has in a lot of ways. But you know, sort of like I said, we're generating very multi-level data at this point. So we have the sequence of the genome, we have all these different functions. And I think there's an incredibly rich amount of research going on now in the statistical community, in the biostatistics community, to start to integrate all of that data and to sort of make some biological conclusions from that data. You know, that's sort of an area that I think has absolutely been taking off over the past few years.
Mm-hmm. And very exciting.
Absolutely.
Well, Tim, in some of the materials I've read about your work and your lab, you discuss the goal of understanding how genetic changes in gene regulation contribute to recent human evolution. Could you elaborate on that concept?
Yeah, so this is sort of one of the things that we find is that, for example, there are some diseases that only humans get. And, you know, if you also look between closely related species, you'll see that the DNA seems to be changing more rapidly in the regions that regulate genes than in the genes themselves. And so, for example, if you compare us and some of the, you know, some of our closest ancestors, you know, the sequence of our genes are actually quite similar and much more similar than you would expect if you just looked at these two organisms, right? And so it seems like a lot of evolution is happening in some of these regulatory regions as well. So a lot of how phenotypes are changing in evolution might also be related to how these phenotypes are changing within a population. By that I mean, you know, why some people are developing disease more often than others.
Mm-hmm. So are humans actually constantly evolving thanks to genetic mutations?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's
despite the idea that some people would like to deny the whole entire concept.
Well, no, we're certainly you know, there's a huge amount of genetic diversity in the human population. Actually, some animal species have much more diversity than us. But that said, you know, we now know from projects like there's a 1,000 Genomes Project where they sequence mm-hmm. the genome of 1,000 individuals, and you can start to see that there's millions and millions and millions of mutations that are different, you know, across humans. Which, you know, sort of when the idea is to try to figure out what all of them do, that presents some really exciting opportunities.
Absolutely. Well, is it theoretically at least possible, Tim, that one day we could gain control over that mutation process and an ability to manipulate it in desired directions?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of, and this gets out of my field, but there is certainly a lot of interest in the idea of gene therapy. So if someone has a mutation that, you know, that causes a disease, could you actually fix that mutation and therefore cure that disease? And certainly when you're thinking about rare diseases, you know, these very Mendelian diseases, these developmental disorders where there's, you know, there's one mutation mm-hmm. in a baby that causes some incredible developmental delay or something like that, right?
Sure.
So, you know, certainly we would love to be able to try to fix that. There's been, and again, this gets sort of outside of my expertise, but there's a huge amount of really exciting research going on right now where we're learning that we can make some of these mutations in certain regions of the genome. I wouldn't say on demand, but we can at least target certain regions, say we want to drive a mutation here or there. So I think we're starting to see some potential for, you know, these types of approaches where, you know, hopefully, you know, gene therapy can go to the next level where we actually say we want to fix, you know, this particular mutation. That would be incredible.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you seem to be at least starting to touch on that area with your recent publication about muscular dystrophy.
Yeah, so this is a collaboration with Charlie Gershbach at Duke, who's you know, this muscular dystrophy has long been a focus of his lab. But yeah, we're starting to get involved. You know, and this is one of the nice things about the GCB at Duke where we work is, you know, Charlie sits across the hall from me. Greg Crawford, another prominent genomics investigator, sits right next to him. You know, and the three of us can bat around ideas all day long. And, you know, so when it comes down to it, you know, Charlie was working on trying to basically cure muscular dystrophy. You know, we can sort of, my lab can contribute some of the understanding of DNA sequence and genome function to kind of help sort of drive that process along a little bit.
Sure. Well, I'd like to talk about that paper in a little more detail. You and Dr. Gershbach mm-hmm. and several of your other colleagues just published this paper describing efforts to correct genetic mutations that cause muscular dystrophy using the CRISPR-Cas9 mm-hmm. Based genome editing platform. And that technology, although it sounds pretty technical, CRISPR-Cas9 seems to be taking the genomics world by storm at this point. And it's pretty exciting as a potential technology to correct the genetic basis of these hereditary or Mendelian diseases, as you described. Tell us more about CRISPR-Cas9, this incredible new, relatively new gene editing tool, and the talk about some of the specifics of the article in Nature Communications.
Yeah, sure. So what we're talking about here, this CRISPR-Cas9 system, it's basically a bacterial immune defense system. So what bacteria have evolved to do, or certain bacteria have evolved to do, is to basically, if they get infected, so bacteria get infections too, and when the bacteria gets an infection, what they've learned to do, what their genomes have learned to do, is to capture some of the DNA of the invader, so they can sort of capture some of the genome of what infected them. And they sort of capture that piece of DNA, and then they store it in their own genome in kind of a sort of a special place, and that's their memory. So, oh, I've seen this thing before. I'm going to store this here. This is sort of the list of things that have invaded me before that I want to protect myself against. And then what the bacteria do is they can constantly monitor their own bodies, their own cells, for those pieces of DNA that came in from the invaders. So they sort of know what they look like. They've stored a copy in their genome. And if they see something else that looks like that come in, then their immune system goes in and basically chops up that DNA. So they chop up the DNA of the invaders.
Okay.
It's sort of this bacterial adaptive immune system. But what's been exciting recently is investigators in several labs have figured out that we can sort of take the system and hijack it for our own purposes. So if we tell this enzyme, we want to look for a certain sequence, you know, ordinarily in the bacteria it'd be an invader sequence, but maybe we want to look for a sequence in our own genome, and we provide the right enzymes, what those enzymes will do actually find the position in our genome that match that sequence and cut that there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our bodies are, you know, our genomes are constantly getting cut. We have UV light can break the genome. The genome is constantly being broken, and so we have a lot of machinery in our bodies to repair that.
Right.
And so you can repair it in several different ways. But basically what happens is if we can introduce that cut using this sort of adaptive immune system, and then we can take control of how that cut is repaired in the genome, we can repair it randomly. We can repair it with a specific new DNA sequence that we want. There's lots of things that you can do in controlling that repair mechanism. And so what this has meant is that now, you know, we can actually say we want to create a cut in, you know, a gene that causes muscular dystrophy, for example. And then when we repair it, we're going to repair it with a copy that actually works, the right copy as opposed to the wrong copy mm-hmm. of the dystrophin gene in this case. And so what we've been doing with Charlie, what Charlie's been really driving on, has been, you know, can we actually take muscle cells that have the muscular dystrophy mutations, can we go in and cut the genome in these particular places and repair it with a functional version of this gene? And then once you've done that, can you actually get those cells to turn into the muscle that you need to potentially cure this, you know, this terrible disease?
And so where does it stand? I understand that the corrections themselves take place in vitro and mm-hmm. cell culture based. And then the corrected cells theoretically are transplanted back into the patient?
Yeah, that's certainly part of the one potential way this could work is you could sort of take cells from the patient, fix the mutation, and then put the cells back in and get those cells to turn into new muscle. There's, you know, none of this is easy. You know, getting sure. the cells from the patient and changing them is hard. Getting them to turn back into muscle is very difficult. All these things are areas where we, you know, have a lot of work to do. But that's sort of the idea, yeah.
I see. So has CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing actually been used in any humans in any capacity yet?
I'm not aware of any. I think there are maybe clinical trials. I'm not aware of anything that's sort of – this is very, very new. You know, this
sure.
is really in the past few years. And,
right.
you know, there's a lot of outstanding questions about, you know, safety and efficacy, you know, these kinds of things. There's a lot of, but this is kind of where we hopefully see the field going in the next, you know, 5-10 years.
I see. So, Tim, what other conditions would this gene editing technology potentially apply to? What can we look for over the next 5 years, say?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, in that case, the field's wide open. I think there's, you know, lots and lots of different diseases are now being studied from this approach. So you can imagine trying to correct mutations associated with muscular dystrophy. You could imagine trying to fix mutations with, you know, any of these other diseases that are caused by maybe one or a very small number of mutations that are tractable.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually, you sort of mentioned the epigenome before. This is sort of the modifications to the genome that control how genes are regulated or contribute to how genes are regulated. And so we've been doing a lot of work as well to try to, you know, say, well, maybe we don't want to edit the DNA sequence. Maybe that's a little bit too scary. Something could go wrong. What if we just edit how the epigenome is programmed, and maybe we can edit gene regulation that way. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a lot of interest in that area. Can we start to use this system to control how genes are regulated without actually mucking with the DNA and potentially, you know, causing some other issues?
Unanticipated.
Exactly.
Right. That sounds not only very exciting, but that sounds right up your alley.
That's certainly, an active area of collaboration we have going on right now.
There you go. Well, do you foresee, substantial further progress in this area with the development of even more versatile and precise gene editing tools?
Yeah, one of the things that's really exciting that's been going on, and, this is part of, this collaboration with Charlie Gershbeck and Greg Crawford, but other investigators as well, is can we take these proteins and basically modify them to do different things and new functions? And so we're learning, for example, that not only can we use them to edit the genome, but you can basically take this protein and this enzyme and you can sort of add on other pieces of other enzymes and kind of make these hybrid enzymes that have new and desired function to study other problems. So yeah, we're certainly working really hard to really just expand the kind of the repertoire of things that we can do, taking the idea that you can target this protein, this enzyme, to a specific place in DNA, and then just using it more as a targeting scaffold to drag along a whole bunch of other, different things that might modify the genome or the epigenome in certain ways.
I see. Well, that's going to be very interesting to keep an eye on progress in that area.
Yep.
At some point, Tim, do there start to be thorny ethical issues here as more control over genes and gene regulation is achieved? Is it all good, or are there potential ethical minefields here?
Oh, well, I mean, absolutely. You have to, when you start to think about when you're going to cure someone of a disease, right? Obviously what you're basically trying to do is you're trying to change a phenotype from one to another. You're trying to change a really terrible disease into, a non-disease. And so someone that has a very challenging life can suddenly have a happy, maybe full life expectancy, right? Mm-hmm. But you can, obviously you get into some really scary issues of, well, maybe I wanted, to change how, something that isn't a disease occurs in someone. Maybe I want to fix baldness. I don't know. I will say, though, that a lot of those types of traits are much different than something like muscular dystrophy. They're caused by lots and lots of genetic changes. And so, I don't really see this getting into a place where we're, starting to change eye color or something like that. I really don't see it going that way. I think there's just too much, mm-hmm. You would have to, it would be ridiculous to try to make that many different mutations. And that's not really a direction that this goes. So yeah, obviously there are some ethical issues, clearly. When you're starting to get into, curing these diseases but also modifying the genome, there's certainly challenges there, but I don't see it turning into changing some more of the common complex phenotypes that are caused by lots and lots and lots of mutations. That's just not how that system could really work, I don't think.
Okay, good. Well, I'm relieved to hear that. You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Dr. Tim Reddy from Duke University, who is exploring the science of gene regulation. Well, Tim, in the lengthy introduction I did, I highlighted the NHGRI grant you just received as part of the Genomics of Gene Regulation, or GGR, program. Tell us more about that program and your part in it.
Yeah, so this is a really exciting program. So this is work from both my lab, but also we've been talking a little bit about the work from the Charlie Gershbeck lab, but also Greg Crawford, Alex Hardemink, and then all these people are at Duke, and then Barbara Engelhardt at Princeton. So kind of as a group of five investigators, what we're trying to do is to take what we learned from the ENCODE project, I'll talk about that in a second, and take that to basically the next level. So what I mean here is we've sequenced the human genome. Then post that sequencing, there's been several rounds and several years, I think almost 10 years of effort now, to try to understand what all of these pieces do. And this is what's been kind of known as the ENCODE project. It's sort of one example. There's other examples like it. There's several projects along this vein. But the idea is, can we comprehensively go through and understand what each of these pieces of the genome do? mm-hmm. whether it's to regulate genes, turn on genes, turn off genes, something, whatever. And that's been very valuable. We now have an incredible catalog of different activities that the genome does. And the next step is to try to say, okay, how do we understand now, you know, we know what these pieces do individually. How do we start to understand, you know, what these pieces do to drive a response to the environment or to drive the response to a drug? A lot of how the genes are regulated change when you differentiate a cell. So when you take, you know, a cell and start to turn it from sort of a sort of basic starting cell into a liver cell or into an eye cell or something like that, something very specialized. That specialization process also involves a lot of these changes. And so the goal here is, can we take this catalog approach and can we now apply it in kind of a cause and effect relationship so we can understand how the genome mediates these effects to the environment, to drugs? In this project in particular, we're looking at how our bodies respond to stress. So if your body, so you sort of go out, you get stressed, and what happens is your body releases several hormones in response to stress, but in particular, we're looking at a hormone called cortisol. Mm-hmm. So this is it's a steroid hormone. It's produced by your adrenal gland. So these are just above your kidneys. And what this basically does is, you know, cortisol goes out into your body. It helps to tone down the immune system. The idea being if you're being chased by a tiger, you know, responding to an infection is probably not my most pressing issue, so we're going to turn down the immune system.
Right.
And also it sort of spurs and sort of modulates energy production as well. So it's part of your flight or fight response.
Sure.
Now it's the anti-inflammatory activities of cortisol that we know and love. So if you've ever had poison ivy, you might get a prednisone cream or you might get a hydrocortisone cream. Mm-hmm. This is basically a synthetic version of cortisol that reduces inflammation potently as a topical cream. And then you can also take it as a pill. So, you know, a lot of times if you're dealing with systemic inflammation, rheumatoid arthritis, some of these sort of long-term inflammatory diseases, cortisol derivatives are really the front line of kind of anti-inflammation.
Sure.
The problem, though, you know, if I have poison ivy and I put some cortisol cream on, no big deal. You know, it goes away in a few days, right? But if you have a sort of a chronic disease, and if I take something like cortisol for 3 to 4 weeks, those metabolic effects that I talked about start to kind of accumulate. And what you end up getting are, in some cases, outright diabetes. You have massive redistribution of fat in your body. You end up gaining a lot of weight. There's, you know, osteoporosis. There's all sorts of really terrible side effects that kind of accumulate and really prevent cortisol and cortisol derivatives from being used in kind of a chronic thing. So you could maybe take an aspirin pill every day, but if you took a cortisol pill every day, you'd end up very, very in very bad shape within several weeks.
Sure.
And so what we're trying to do in this study is to understand how it is that cortisol influences the immune system and influences metabolism. And the long-term goal is, can we start to separate that? Can we start to identify, well, what are the things that cortisol does when it interacts with the genome to drive inflammatory responses, and where are the places where it interacts with the genome to drive metabolic responses? And maybe long term, we could even start to think about, well, how could we modulate that? How could we come up with derivatives of cortisol that only touch the immune system and don't touch the metabolic system? That would be great. Then some of these rheumatoid arthritis patients would have a long term treatment that they can rely on.
Sure. Well, I think many of us know or have known people who have been on long-term prednisone treatment, mm-hmm. things like that. And yeah, they always seem to gain weight, and that is a debilitating side effect of many of those drugs.
Yeah, you're really stuck with sort of two bad options.
Yeah, so, you know, something, development of those kind of drugs without that profile would be a major advance.
Yeah, that's I mean, you know, again, this is very long-term, but we're right. hoping to kind of lay the sort of the mechanistic foundation that will let us understand how to do that better.
Okay, so are you looking to manipulate the response to cortisol at the genetic level, or changing the glucocorticoid molecules themselves?
So in this project, we're trying to change the response at the sort of genetic level. So, mm-hmm. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to start to understand this response, you know, at a level of depth that I think is really unprecedented. So, you know, we understand what happens when you give someone this drug for an hour to cells. We understand what happens a little bit on more of a longer scale. But what we don't really understand are kind of, you can sort of think of this complex set of proteins that are all interacting and all responding across, you know, 12 to 14 hours as sort of that initial response. And so what we're trying to do is to really get a very deep molecular mechanistic understanding of how cortisol is acting to change what genes are being used. So that's the first step. And the idea is that once we have this sort of model, this, you know, really intimate understanding of how genes are regulated by cortisol, then we can start to go in and test some hypotheses. So if I manipulate how this one gene responds to cortisol, what are the downstream effects of that? And if I manipulate how this other gene responds to cortisol, what are the downstream effects of that? And hopefully we can start to come up with the right sets of manipulations that will allow us to increase or at least maintain the sort of the inflammatory responses, anti-inflammatory responses, but start to tune down or attenuate some of those metabolic responses. So this might be through editing the genome like we've talked about. It might be through editing the epigenome like we've talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of ways that we can basically reprogram these cells to not have as much of a metabolic side effect. Obviously, this isn't a drug that's going to be used in treatment, but the idea is if we can start to pull apart the network in this way, then when we design these drugs, we at least know what we're trying to recapitulate, what kind of effects we're trying to screen for.
So you'll be characterizing the, I think they're termed these days, adverse outcome pathways?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to, so this study is only being done in cells, so we're not going to actually get into, getting into patient populations.
I see.
And we're really just focusing, it's more of a characterizing the primary cortisol response as opposed to, you know, some of the different corticosteroids that are out there.
I see. Okay. Well, so the grant, the piece of the NHGRI grant is $5.9 million.
Yep.
What is the time frame for that, and how do you plan to actually spend that money?
So one of the things that's really exciting about that grant is it's a three-year grant. So we have basically 3 years to spend, you know, on the order of $5-6 million. And what that means, so just to give people a sort of a sense of the cost of biomedical research, you know, a standard grant is something on the order of $400,000-$500,000 a year, and that'll fund a pretty standard, like, aggressive research project. And what we're looking at here is roughly triple that. And so what that means is that we're going to, you know, have this really massive, aggressive data generation campaign. We're scaling up the lab phenomenally, hiring lots of individuals. If there's any molecular biologists, we have some job ads out there you can apply. And we're trying to, you know, when we're talking about characterizing this response, we're talking about doing something on the order of 3,000 to 4,000 different experiments to characterize different parts of the cortisol response. So massive data generation effort. And we really view this, this is useful for our lab, of course, but we think this is also a very good community resource, sort of a worldwide resource where, you know, all of this data is going to go out into the public domain. It's going to be free for anyone to download. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's interested in these cortisol responses can grab our data and can analyze it in their own different ways, right? And then in conjunction with that, we have, you know, half of the team, which I haven't even talked about yet, half of the team is doing, you know, a lot of this network modeling that we're talking about. So, you know, you can imagine that understanding the 3 billion base pairs of the genome is complicated. Well, now imagine when those 3 billion base pairs of the genome change what they do across 12 hours and interact with each other. You end up with a number of possible kind of interactions that you could never possibly analyze. And so we have a lot of, you know, this is some of the work that Alex Hardemink and Barbara Engelhardt bring to the team. Some really exciting advanced, these kind of Bayesian models that try and take the complexity of this space that we're looking at and really take it down to a small number of what are called factors, a small number of kind of important, important things that are happening that we can really focus on. And so by basically reducing the complexity to something that we can actually do computation on, you know, we hope that we'll get a better understanding of how these cortisol responses occur.
I see. Well, it's just remarkable that the amazing tools that have been developed just in really the last few years, the Bayesian networking mm-hmm. you talked about, the statistical modeling capabilities have really come along to meet the experimental capabilities to allow you to do some of these really important things.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's kind of fun to think about is, you know, you can imagine a cortisol response, right? So, you know, we're going to measure it every hour, but you could imagine measuring every 30 seconds or every millisecond or every nanosecond, right?
Mm-hmm.
So almost, you know, you sort of think about, well, we're going to do these 4,000 experiments. This is a huge scale compared to, you know, some of these more typically sized research projects. But we're never going to actually get every possible experiment done. There's an infinite number of experiments, and, you know, that's completely impossible. And so we think of this as being very sparse. So on the one hand, we're generating, you know, something on the order of 100 terabytes of data.
Wow.
On the other hand, you know, the Bayesian statisticians are like, yeah, it's still sparse. Like, you don't have very much data, actually. And so it's kind of this interesting mix of dealing with huge amounts of data and realizing that you've only got a tiny little fraction of a view of what's actually happening.
Indeed. Well, Tim, how will this project, your piece of this larger GGR grant, how will it fit in with some of the other studies that have been funded under this grant?
Yeah, so right. So there's, you know, as you mentioned, there's several other studies. There's studies in how keratinocytes, so basically how skin cells develop, so how your body basically produces new skin cells. There's several other projects looking at how your immune system works, so how your body responds to, or how your cells respond to, you know, a bacterial infection, something like that, right? And, you know, what these projects all have in common is they're all trying to understand how genes are turned on and how genes are turned off in response to the environment or in response to their own sort of differentiation pathway. And all of them are also, like I said, for our project, we're all putting the data into the public domain. So it's all going to be available for anyone to use. These are meant to be worldwide resources that will be used by hopefully thousands and thousands of researchers.
Sure, that's great.
And so what's exciting is that, you know, what I hope is that the principles that we learn about that govern how genes are turned on and off in response to cortisol and how these sort of larger networks form, that there might be something common in how the immune system also turns on and off genes and how the long-term effects on the immune system occur. Similarly with keratinocyte skin cell development, right? And so hopefully, you know, at the intersection of all these projects, we'll learn some new core principles that really govern how genes are turned on and turned off. And I think that's really the key if we're going to eventually understand how, you know, how some of these different diseases develop. For example, we need to know how genes are turned on and off in these different diseases. You know, having some basic principles, which we don't really have a good handle on right now, I think will be, you know, instrumental in moving the field forward.
Well, it's going to be very important as time goes on, because those principles you're describing are going to be applicable to so many different things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope. The hope is that what we learn here we'll be able to then use to study, you know, how you respond to, you know, how you respond to toxins in the environment, or how you respond to, mm-hmm. you know, bacteria that are good for you. You know, all sorts of things. You can imagine lots of different ways that your bodies respond, and having some really core principles to anchor that, I think, will be very valuable.
Absolutely. Well, Tim, you have a foot in both computational biology mm-hmm. and genomics, as we've been discussing. Do you see any real dividing line between those two fields anymore, or is it a irrelevant distinction at this point?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on this. I you know, the fields have certainly been moving closer together, absolutely. And there's, you know, certainly value, I think, at least in my lab, of having a foot in both area, that you can, you know, understand but also perform the studies of how genes are regulated, and that you can also understand and develop the ways that you analyze that data. And I think having that closely linked within a lab is extremely powerful.
Sure.
You know, that said, if you're going to be a master of two trades, then you have a couple limitations on both ends of that spectrum. So I think just as much as there's value in developing labs like mine, I think there's also incredible value in the people that are, you know, spending their lives just thinking about some of these advanced statistical techniques, and people that are just sitting there thinking about, you know, all the molecular biology that we need to understand. So there's certainly, I think, a lot of value in that specialization. It's just nice to see that there's a lot of growth in the middle of those as well.
I see. Very good. Well, Tim, I also wanted to ask you about another article that you and some of your colleagues recently published mm-hmm. in Nature Communications, describing a novel genetic mechanism of gestational glucose regulation. So tell us more about the role of maternal glucose levels during pregnancy and gestational diabetes, DNA and the potential genetic component that you've identified.
Yeah, this is a kind of an interesting study for us. You know, one of the things we try to do, as we've been talking about, is start to figure out how changes in gene regulation contribute to a phenotype. And one of the ways...
I guess we should define for our listeners what phenotype.
Yeah, sorry. By phenotype, I mean a disease or, you know, something that you can see in a hair color is a phenotype.
A trait.
A trait, yes.
Thank you. Okay.
And you know, there's ways that we can look at it, but one of the things I think is really valuable, that I highly value, is getting a few proof of principles out there. So can we actually, you know, we could talk about this at kind of a high level, but if we don't actually make some impacts on a few diseases, then maybe we're barking up the wrong tree. And so, you know, early on in these investigations, we started working with an investigator, Bill Lowe, at the University of Northwestern University. And what Bill had done is he helped organize this really incredible study that monitored 30 to 40,000 women throughout pregnancy. And the goal of the study was to basically understand, you know, what's sort of the epidemiology, what are the things that go wrong during pregnancy, and also to understand what the effect is on the children. And part of that was understanding the genetic contribution. So can we start to identify certain mutations that are more likely to be found in women that have problems during childbirth or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so one of the findings that came out of this, so one of the common problems that can occur, complications that can occur during pregnancy, is gestational diabetes. So this is typically in the third trimester. And, you know, you can imagine, so you have a woman who is, you know, there's the developing fetus, and basically, you know, you have your own need to, you know, manage energy levels, but now the mother's also trying to manage the energy levels available to a developing baby. And so what this causes is a really drastic change in how sugar, glucose in this case, how sugar is regulated within the body during pregnancy. And so in most women, this happens no problem. You sort of adapt to the fact that you need to, you know, generate more energy to support the developing fetus. And then the baby's born, and then you kind of go back to normal, right?
Right.
But in some women, they lose control, their bodies lose control of how glucose is regulated. And this results in basically having too much sugar in your blood, and this is diabetes. So if you develop diabetes during pregnancy, it's known as gestational diabetes. So circling back now to this HAPO study, this is the study of the 30,000 women with Bill Lowe, what they started to find was genetic mutations that predict whether a woman is more likely to develop gestational diabetes. So it's more likely to lose control of sugar regulation, glucose regulation towards the end of their pregnancies. And when we started to look at where those mutations were occurring, most of them occur actually around the same genes that contribute to type 2 diabetes, to adult onset diabetes, the diabetes that most people will acquire, that adults acquire, you know, later in life, the sort of adult onset diabetes. It's sort of, most of the genes were involved in that, but there's one mutation that we found that was associated with this gene that really had no known function. It was associated, we thought, with how that gene was regulated. It didn't seem to impact the gene itself. And it was around this time that I met with Bill, and we said, well, let's see if we can figure out what's going on here, right? And so one of the students in my lab, Carl Guo, he started going through and systematically asking, you know, what are the mutations around this gene that change how it might be regulated? And a little bit surprising, I think, to us, we started to find quite a few. We said, okay, there's actually quite a lot of mutations here. And when we started to reference back to the women who were more likely to get gestational diabetes, and I should be clear, it's actually not diabetes that we're looking at, but just hyperglycemia, so just elevated blood sugar in the first place. When we went back and looked, we found that all of the mutations, more or less, that were associated with having gestational diabetes or developing this glucose problem, were all associated with decreasing the expression of this unknown gene. And we thought that was pretty surprising. But the problem was we still didn't know what this gene did. And that's when we kind of had to take a long look at ourselves and be like, okay, let's stop doing the genetics for a second and let's figure out what the heck this gene does.
Sure.
And so, you know, one of the nice things is we have sequences of our genomes. We have sequences of lots of different species. We have, you know, we have a lot of DNA sequence we can look at. And we started looking at this gene and trying to figure out, well, what does it look like? Does it look like a different gene that might give us a hint as to what it does?
Mm-hmm.
And when we looked at this, we found that it actually looks a lot like some of the genes that metabolize sugar that have been really well studied for 40 to 50 years. And, you know, these are called hexokinases. What that means is basically that you add a small phosphate group to a sugar, and that's kind of the first step in that, turning that sugar into energy. So the field has been unanimous for a long time that there are really four of these genes in the human body. There's four genes that kick off this sugar metabolism process. But it looked like we were staring at a fifth one, and we, you know, that was really, really unexpected to us. But, you know, science sort of dictates you have to ask these hypotheses, and so we said, okay, well, does this gene do the same thing as the other four? And through, you know, several experiments, Carl was really dogged about this, about doing the experiments, repeating them, doing a different way, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we were able to show, you know, really conclusively that, indeed, this gene does kick off sugar metabolism in some ways. Really surprising both to the field, because we thought there were only four of these genes. There's a whole new area of how sugar is regulated. And particularly interesting because, you know, it seems to be especially useful or especially important to how sugar is regulated during pregnancy. And so, you know, we're starting to wonder if this gene might have, you know, a specific role in helping the mother adapt to the additional, metabolic energy needs of a developing fetus.
Yeah, that sounds just amazing. So the obvious question generated by what you've just described is, does that finding suggest any kind of new strategies for either treatment or prevention of gestational diabetes, which, as you've described, is quite common?
Yeah, it happens in, you know, I looked up the numbers this year, it's something around 400,000 birth or 400,000 pregnancies a year in the U.S. are impacted by gestational diabetes, or gestational hyperglycemia, something in the order of 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's two possibilities that can come out of this, two, I think, potential fruitful areas. You know, one is on the area of prevention and the other is on the area of actual treatment. And, you know, typically, sort of diagnosis and prevention is a lot easier than treatment. And so that's probably where we'll see the first benefits. And so there's a lot of work that we're doing now to try to, and this is, again, with Bill Lowe at Northwestern and a few others there, trying to understand, can we take what we've found and use that to potentially screen women and say, okay, you know, based on your DNA, you're more likely to develop gestational diabetes than someone who doesn't have some of these mutations.
So does that imply potential preventive measures, starting a strict diet sooner in the pregnancy?
You know, that's kind of the hope. I mean, it's very early days, but that's kind of where we would like to see, hopefully, that this could go. I think that's certainly, you know, if, you know, obviously maintaining, you know, a healthy diet during pregnancy is extremely valuable, and that's probably first and foremost. And whether you know your genetic makeup, you should probably be doing that anyway.
Indeed.
And that's sort of the typical, you know, response to this. But, you know, that said, you know, if you did know that you were at particular risk for one reason or another, maybe that would be enough to amp up your awareness, or maybe it would be enough just to start testing a little bit earlier, right? So maybe if you could, you know, test earlier, you could detect it earlier in the pregnancy, maybe you could correct it before it becomes full-blown diabetes, something
sure.
like that. So I think there's lots of possibilities there. Now, when you're talking about actual treatment and actually fixing the problem, or, you know, there might be some people where no matter what they eat, and lots of women have perfectly healthy diets in pregnancy and still develop gestational diabetes, right?
Someone near and dear to me has just been through that.
Yeah. So you know, it's not just diet-related. It's genetic-related too, right? And so we'd like to be able to treat those individuals as well. What's exciting about these genes that metabolize sugar is they actually bind lots and lots of little small molecules in your body. So they bind the glucose molecule itself, but they also bind these other atoms that they want to add on to the glucose molecule. And then they have to bind some other molecules as well that help these enzymes work. So there's lots and lots of small molecules, you know, tens, twenties of atoms that are binding to this thing. And when a protein binds a small molecule, the pharmaceutical industry is like, well, you know, that's a drug. A drug is you get small molecules that can bind a enzyme or bind a protein and change how it works, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the exciting potentials is that we could find small molecules that actually change how this protein works, change how this enzyme works. And maybe if we could do that, then we could, you know, make up for the fact that its expression has changed. So if it's expressed, like we think, if it's expressed too low, maybe we could find a molecule that would allow it to work a little bit more effectively, but that wouldn't hit those other four glucose metabolizing enzymes. Because if you hit all of them, you might have a huge systematic effect. Maybe you can just target the pregnancy specific one. That would be exciting.
Sure. Well, we'll be on the lookout for that development. Well, Tim, the hour has just flown by and we are already out of time.
Wow.
So I want to thank you for sharing so much information with us about your very exciting work at Duke in the world of gene regulation.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, or our Facebook site for our lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. One great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website, wcomfm.org, click on the Donate Now button, and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution via a secure donation on PayPal to help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.